online, turn that grade around. Improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit atthebascu.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
Everyone, my name's Josh Carton. I'm a professor and the Associate Dean for Grad Studies and Program Development here at Queen's. Delighted to welcome you to today's hybrid in-person and online webinar with Dr. Petra Butler. To begin, though, it's incumbent on us to recall that we are now on the traditional territories of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy and Anishinaabeg Nation. And to acknowledge that traditional territory is to recognize its lengthy history, its significance for its original inhabitants, and the ancient customs and practices that are still alive today on these lands. And we're grateful to be able to live, work, play, and today to learn here. Since it is also November 11th, I want to take a moment to recognize the heroism and the loss of many Canadians and the many people from around the world who have given their lives in the many wars that this species inflicts upon each other. At a time of instability like the one we are increasingly living in today, where more and more humans are living and dying in conditions of war, it's even more important to recall the sacrifices, both the personal sacrifices and the instrumental sacrifices by governments of people who have fallen in wars of the past and the present. With that solemn duty performed, I'm delighted to welcome Petra Butler, our speaker today. She grew up in Brunswick, not the one in Atlantic Canada, not the new one, the original one in Germany. Traveled to New Zealand to get an LLM, and I think, although physically you went back and forth, it seems emotionally you never really left New Zealand. And after completing her PhD at the University of Göttingen, returned to Wellington, where she spent bulk of her academic career, but since last year has been the Executive Dean of the Faculty of Law at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. Her research deals with international commercial law, which is where I got to know her work and where we've sort of intersected at times in the past, but also in human rights and in the intersection between the two, and increasingly on issues of access to justice, which I think is fair to say is the underlying theme of your presentation today on small and medium-sized enterprises. She's also the director of the Institute of Small and Micro States, and if you're interested in that, I'm sure she'd be happy to take questions on that topic as well afterwards. So please, welcome, Dean Petra Butler.
Thank you so much, Josh. That was such a nice introduction. And I also would like to acknowledge the traditional peoples of this land. And so Kia ora koutou, everybody, which is the traditional Maori. Welcome. I'm really glad to be here. And I've been here about, I was thinking 20 years ago, making snow angels with my three children and Bruce. So it was winter after all, so I didn't get to see that much of Kingston actually. On one thing I want to share is that my children learned to play chess, courtesy of Bruce here in Kingston. So that set them off on a very important kind of pastime. So what I really would like to talk about is small and medium-sized enterprises, which seems to be a little bit of an odd topic. And one thing I really would like to say first up is a presentation of what I'm going to talk about often does not excite lawyers at all. But the moment I talk with economists about it, they're incredibly excited about it, which I find quite interesting. And I have been involved in two access to justice projects, one led by the Max Planck Institute and one by the International Academy of Comparative Law, both on access to justice and commercial access to justice. And in both, I was the only human rights lawyer on that, you know, both led by civil proceduralists. And I think that is also for me, that's before I even start talking, something actually really interesting to note. So I think what I'm getting at is that even though, and I come to this now, 97.8% of Canadian businesses are small and medium sized or small, they actually don't seem to play a role at all when we're thinking about this, any kind of access to justice issues. And I thought I give you a little bit of a definition. So in Canada, and the definition of what a small business is different in each country. In Canada, it is 1 to 99 employees. In large businesses would be 500 or more employees, so everything in between is a medium size. And on December 2022, there were 1.22 million employer businesses, so businesses that employed people, right? And of that, 97.8% were small. So that's pretty much the same in every other country. So I think what unifies small and medium-sized enterprises in a certain way is that wherever you are, a country would always define the small business that it makes up between 97 and 99% of all businesses. In New Zealand, the numbers are smaller, so a small business would be between 1 and around 50 employees. And if you go to Fiji, you know, which has vaguely 2 million people, it's around 30. Yeah. So in Ontario, you have 445,000 small businesses, and but overall, they employ basically 47% of all employees, also of the entire labor force. So they are actually really important, and they make up 40.8% of the total value of exporter goods. So they are really important with export and the exports, and this is where I'm going to look at, because I'm going to look at dispute resolution cross-border. Now, the other thing to also note, because there is an access to justice issue, because they're small, and I really would like to show you this. So if we look at the world of an SME owner, what a small business owner actually does. So they're their own accountant. They actually need to look after their money. So in a certain way, they take up some of the banking function. They have to deal with transport. So they need to have knowledge there. They do their own advertising and marketing. They have to manufacture, because lots of them are in the manufacturing business. So they have to look that or provide a service. So they have to have the knowledge there. And they're actually their own lawyers. Yeah? And as you can see, and this is often, and many of them are owner-operated, they have to do a lot of things all at the same time. Yeah? And that actually causes some issues. Yeah. And the other thing is they often don't have a lot of capital. So what we've got is, even in the Canadian context, and I had a quick chat with Josh about this. So looking at the latest case in contract law, which is EarthCo Soil Mixture and Pine Valley Enterprises, and both have an ink at the end, in that case, referring to older cases, and those companies have a limited or a co-op at the end, I can tell you, and this is not only in Canada, it's everywhere in the common law, that most contract law cases are actually decided on the issues that large companies have and not small companies. So you're creating the common law, contract law, which actually is for 3% of all businesses and not for the 97.8. Yeah, so that's aside. So just to give you a little bit of an idea why I find this all really interesting. Right, so we have some kind of contractual realities. And one thing we found, and we interviewed in Spain and Austria, in New Zealand, and we did through the Commonwealth Secretariat and the back of an international commercial arbitration study. Also, we basically interviewed businesses all around the Commonwealth. Yeah? Relatively difficult, and it's statistically probably not the greatest or most reliable, but it gives you an insight. And the EU has done the same, and especially the EU research, which is now 15 years old, but they found that actually the uncertainty around dispute resolution and the contract law when trading cross-border is one of the largest trade barriers. And that is basically what we found as well when we interviewed. So let's have a look, and I have a couple of quotes. Otherwise, I'm trying not to use PowerPoints that much, but I thought the quotes are actually quite cool. And so So we interviewed in New Zealand and Singapore. We did 40 small businesses in New Zealand, which actually is statistically for qualitative empirical research and New Zealand standards huge. So all my business colleagues that deal with SMEs, they interview 10 and then say that is statistically all right. Yeah, so we did 40. And So there is a theme coming through, yeah? And one is the use of a single contract document. And if you read those quotes, one thing is really clear. Most of them do not use one single contract document. This is what we tell our students, yeah? You have a contract and you have clause 1 to 20 or 1 to 30, and that's fantastic. And everything is in this contract, you know, parole evidence rule, nothing what's not in there you can't use. And so this is not how it works in reality. The funniest thing is if they deal with China, they do have WeChat. If they deal with Australia, they use WhatsApp. You know, previously, 10 years ago, they used a lot of Sky. Now they use Zoom or Teams. Yeah? So completely, and if you're really lucky, then you have an order form where they actually have at least some of, you know, the quantity, the quality all in there, you know, maybe some dates, but then you're actually already lucky. Yeah? What you also see is, and this is why I was talking about, you know, what, you know, their mental capacity, the cognitive, the variety of things they need to have actually in their head is, for them reading a document, like a normal contract document, is actually hard work. Yeah? And I really hate to say this, but lots of those small businesses we're talking about, you know, they're in the manufacturing business. So that's what they love, you know, they love to manufacture, they love to retail. They didn't want to become lawyers. Yeah, so they have too much to do. You know? Crazy idea, you know. They have actually too much to do, you know, to actually think about these legal terms, and they're scary. And if you have friends who are not lawyers, even doctors or so on, you know, like they find some contracts scary too. So, right. So they have a complete lack of awareness of cross-border dispute resolution issues. You know, and if you look at the first quote, it's like, you know, when we are talking with somebody, that's the law that applies, yeah? Couldn't be further from reality, but that's all right, you know? And that's a common sense approach. And the other idea is that they basically have no legal standing, yeah? So they just think the law doesn't help them anyway. So we're actually not interested. There is a lack of legal advice, and I'm not, and that probably will be the same. It's the same in Spain, and it was the same in New Zealand. I assume it will be the same here if you get outside the big centers. Finding a lawyer who actually has the knowledge of cross-border contracts is, you find that in Toronto, you probably find it here in the big firms. But, you know, it's hard, yeah? And in New Zealand, I can tell you, you definitely don't find it. Then think about this further. For those small business owners, I mean, I'm just thinking New Zealand, yeah? They will never go to the big firms. As a they can't, it's too expensive. The other thing, though, is their reception is so scary for them, yeah? That they don't want to go there. Yeah, and then probably the lawyer doesn't speak the language they understand, but their lawyer who does speak their language, which is the lawyer next door, yeah, they probably don't know anything about cross-border contracting. So that's another really access to justice issue. And I also think, because having talked to some of the partners in the big, at least New Zealand firms, they said, oh, but it's not a problem. We know all about it. And I thought, yeah, but for every SME that comes through your door, there are probably 200 who don't make it. You know, so, and I also, basically the caveat here is, as well, a little bit, I have to be honest, is small businesses that have a high IP, they will use lawyers, yeah? But that's through the IP. They know that they need to protect their IP, and then they're nearly there, yeah? But, right. So what do? They generally self-hedge. And they do that, and then I found that really interesting is, at least in New Zealand and sometimes in Spain, they can get nearly half of their payment done up front, which is also nothing we teach students, because we always teach students, if you think about the Wismut, about the letter of credit. Now, letter of credits, at least for New Zealand sellers or buyers, are out because sellers is too expensive and too complicated. So they get payment terms. They definitely rely on trust and relationships. So I've talked, that was pre-COVID though, with small business owners. So New Zealand was the first country with a free trade agreement with China. So there was quite a good exchange with China. They actually, and I'm not kidding, they invited their potential contract partner for a skiing holiday weekend to New Zealand. And if that went well, then the trust was established and then a contract made. The other thing they, and then vice versa, this flip side of that coin is, yeah, one bad experience in the country. So I've talked to somebody who had one bad experience with a small country, another country, and they would never trade there again. So then the other way they do look at relationships is they might ask friends or other companies, have you had, you know, some experience, and with whom have you partnered? So that is also, so they're restricting basically trade to familiar countries as well. Yeah, so in New Zealand would be Australia, here it would be probably the US. So I just wanted to summarize it, and the quote in the white one I might read out because that's my favorite quote. But basically, good relations. So it's all about good relationships, yeah. And so, and actually giving somebody a contract, a written contract, is already, yeah, a sign of mistrust, right? So one, and this is a quote, yeah. So I didn't make this up. No, because America, you know, don't kid yourself. The Americans are not going to sue me. I could poison and kill an American with my product, and they wouldn't sue me because the lawyers would not make enough. They could take me to the cleaners, they could take my business, they could take my wife and children and sell them into slavery, and they still would not make enough to pay their fee. Yeah? This is one way how you do risk management, yeah? So that's basically how what we have. That's what we're working with, yeah? But we also know, and this is the important part, that if for governments, for SMEs to trade cross-border is one of the ways to actually lift your GDP. Yeah, so that's probably at this stage nearly the only way, because the large companies have all done what they need to do. Also not to forget that in developing countries, cross-border trade and small businesses is one way to lift women out of poverty. So this is just saying it is really important. So we have the problem, and at the moment, and you probably all know this, they have theoretically three options. They can litigate, they can arbitrate, and they can mediate. They have generally no idea what that is. Yeah, I heard one small business owner saying to me, oh, arbitration is, oh, I don't really like this tree-hugging experience. You know, and of course, everybody who's ever done arbitration would say it's never a tree-hugging experience. And often they don't make a choice, and sometimes you don't want them to make a choice. I've seen one contract between an Australian seller and an Italian buyer where they made a choice, and the choice was, if there was an issue with a product, yeah, then it would be Italian law and the Italian courts. If there would be an issue with the payments, it would be Australian law and the Australian courts, yeah, which makes common sense, perfect sense, yeah. If you're a layperson, yeah. For every lawyer, you know, this is an absolute nightmare. But so we, in one sense, don't want them to make a choice in lots of ways. So what? And this is actually not my idea. I have to say. So there are two ways to look at it. We could look at ODR, so online dispute resolution, yeah. And I did play in British Columbia, it's quite up there. That's one of the, and I had a little bit of a play with their process. You know, at least at the beginning, I was a seller, you know, and I didn't get payment from my buyer. And I looked at what they were doing, and it's actually quite nicely done. I actually think, again, think about it, that trust is an underlying feature. Think about that a lot of those business paper manufacturers, yeah, language might not be their forte, yeah, especially if you're manufacturing goods, you know, and they know if they make a mistake and they don't get the payment. that it might be the make or break of a company. Yeah, if they're losing $2 million Canadian dollars or $2 million New Zealand dollars, that might be the end of it. So even though I think it's very nicely done and it's relatively easy, and they also encourage, you know, basically negotiation before you can get your, I mean, I don't need to tell you what they're doing, you know this better than I do, but before they have a tribunal member to decide, I still think maybe the pandemic has made it a little bit easier, but I think there is still an incredibly high barrier because, you know, for them to sit down and write might be really, really difficult or be very kind of angst filled. The other thing is you could look at state purchase insurance. Yeah, that's definitely something happens sometimes. Or you could, what they came up with, what they also really would like, is to register at the Chambers of Commerce or the Trade Mission on trustworthy businesses. Now, I don't have to tell you that of course has all other issues related, and you can see the diplomatic incidences already, so I don't think that's going to happen. Now, the other thing you could look at is a specialized dispute resolution mechanism, based on international arbitration. So I have to confess that that's not my idea. So that idea was born also not nearly 10 years ago by Gary Bourne as a famous BAT, the bilateral arbitration treaty regime. That got a little bit of backlash, but I still think it is a fantastic idea. I just thought I'd rename in this for our presentation. I acknowledge that and rename it because I think there's one thing I would do differently. And or emphasized differently. So what you would do is, at the moment, the litigation is a default mechanism. So if they don't decide on anything, it will go to court. That's a default. So when we come to this, and litigation has a lot of issues. So this is the doctrinal, this is the background. So I just want to pick out a couple of things, and I can give you the PowerPoint presentation, you have that, and you can read through each of them because otherwise it's getting too long. But the real issue normally is enforceability. At the moment, if you go to court, there is no worldwide reliable enforcement regime. You know, you have this is one of the advantages of the Brussels regulation. You know, the EU has a very good one. We have the Judgments Convention from The Hague, but that hasn't been signed by enough countries and is relatively new. International arbitration, we have over 163 states having signed up for 172, I think, by now, to the New York Convention, which basically means that you can take your arbitral award to anywhere where the assets are, and in theory, at least, the court will enforce that. That is a real advantage, yeah? And I mean, if you think about it, you can have the best judgment in the world in your favor. If you can't enforce it, it's not even worth the paper it's written on. So this makes arbitration such an attractive dispute resolution mechanism, and still also better than mediation because the equivalent Singapore convention has not been signed and the EU is against it. So that is an issue. So that makes it really, really, really attractive. And I want to give you one example, and that was like finding the famous needle in the haystack. In 2015, Nelson Honey, Manuka Honey, so one of New Zealand's biggest sellers, had a distribution agreement with a Singaporean company. It was distributing honey to China. The honey made it to Shanghai. There, the distributor actually said, this honey looks not like we think Manuka honey should look like, and we actually don't take delivery. So they sued, Nelson Honey sued in the Nelson High Court for purchase price payment. At the same time, the Singaporean distributor sued in the Singaporean High Court on delivery. Both courts said their decisions, we have jurisdiction. So if you imagine that, both would have decided in favor of the claimant, You would have been in the, to the rest of your time in parallel proceedings trying to enforce those judgments, yeah, with no end in sight. So there are no further, after the jurisdiction judgment, there are no further judgments, so we know they have settled. But, so parallel proceedings and enforcement are the both things which actually have, don't happen in arbitration. And so that are, I think, the two really big advantages. And costs might be another one, because in arbitration you don't need, you just need one set of lawyers generally and not two. So that's really good, and you can design your own procedure, which might be, if you can come from two different jurisdictions, quite favorably. Yeah? So this is in a nutshell why arbitration in this particular circumstance is probably better. So what you need to get around is, of course, arbitration is consent-based, and what you actually really want to do ideally, and this is why it's treaty-based, is you want to substitute the default of litigation and make it a state-mandated system. Yeah, so that the default is we're doing this, and this is why I always say based on international arbitration, because I need to get around the consent part. Based on international arbitration, on the principles of international arbitration, rather than saying it is international arbitration, because that has certain issues. Yeah? But it will still allow everybody who wants to go to litigation, obviously, to go to litigation or mediation. So that's basically, that's the idea. And I have kind of summarize that. So by doing that, you could actually use the unsectoral arbitration rules as a neutral system, because unsectoral, of course, as a UN, commercial UN body, already has thought about what are the best procedures when it comes to arbitration. So that should make it quite acceptable across the board. We talked about enforcement already. We talked about that the local counsel who knows the business best could, in theory, appear, yeah? So you don't need doubling up on counsel. And you could, and this is another really good advantage of arbitration, of course, you could actually choose somebody as an arbitrator who might know something about the goods or the service, you know, where the dispute is about. You know, you can get somebody specialized. So who knows a little bit more about honey than maybe your normal judge does, yeah? So to get around the discoloration. So I just basically said it does provide, would foster trade. Now in the Commonwealth's survey, Commonwealth Secretariat survey we did, we actually asked that question. And we did not, we described it as I described it. So I avoided the bilateral arbitration treaty, the bad kind of synonym, and described it like that. And interestingly enough, all state governments that replied, yeah, even the arbitration institutions, all arbitrators, like 90%, and all the lawyers also, like vast majority, are probably also nearly 90%, described like that, said it would be a good idea. I had conversations with that, with the New Zealand government. Where we're getting at is exactly that. I can get the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, their economists, not a problem. The moment I talk to the lawyers, it's like, no way. Yeah, and I find that really interesting, and that, for me, really interesting in itself. Yeah. You can help, you can raise a standard as well, you can be more competitive, you can especially also raise certain minimum standards in by doing that in how companies actually contract with each other. So I think it's overall quite, either for me, it's kind of a win-win. And so if you look at that, what I've done is just to come back to that, what it would do, it would actually, look at this, help us, you know, to deal with a big dispute resolution issue we've got. And with that, Thank you, and I thought we hopefully have some time now for questions and discussion.
I'm Colleen Flatt. I'm the Dean of the Law School, and a warm welcome to everybody here in the room and online. I'd like to open today's proceedings with our usual but heartfelt acknowledgement for the lands that Queens is on and that most of us live and work and raise our families on, the traditional lands of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe's peoples. And when we make these acknowledgements, we're acknowledging the deep significance of the land for Indigenous peoples across Turtle Island in Canada, and the great fortune that we have to be here. Our law school is working on pathways along truth and reconciliation. Professor Burrows, who's here, and others are working on a new course in Indigenous law and Aboriginal law for first year. And as well, she and other faculty and students are baby steps towards an Indigenous clinic, a legal aid clinic in partnership with a Friendship Centre to support local Indigenous peoples. So we're on this path for a long time, full time, all the time. These are some of the steps that we're making. So I'm really thrilled to introduce my friend, the wonderful Professor Richard Moon, here today to talk about freedom of expression. As we know, it's a critical topic at this point in time. And I'd like to first thank Associate Dean of Research Sherry Metcalf and all the team for helping organize this visit by Dick and the talk today. Most of you know that Dick is the distinguished university professor at the University of Windsor. He's got a clutch of books. I think that's an unofficial kind of description. The Life and Death of Freedom of Expression, which was published by U of T Press in 2024. Putting Faith in Hate, When Religion is the Source or Target of Hate Speech, published with Cambridge University Press in 2018. Freedom of Conscience and Religion, which was published by first by Irwin in 2014 and then again this year. The second edition, I should say. And The Constitutional Protection of Freedom of Expression, again by U of T Press in 2000. He's also edited or co-edited several collections today. Sorry, I'm seeming to struggle with words. Indigenous Spirituality and Religious Freedom, which was published by U of T Press in 20... Not yet. Still coming.
Sure. It's coming.
I was going to say your affinity for the press is heartening. And he's been the recipient of both the law school and university-wide teaching awards at Windsor, as well as several community service awards, including the Sir Muhammad Zafrullah Khan Distinguished Public Service Award. So welcome. Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.
I also wonder who is a postdoctoral fellow in the university, at the Queen's University in the Department of Political Science. And his research examines the law and politics of extending constitutional protections for expression to university campuses, which responds to some developments in law and policy that have occurred during his doctoral research. And so we're so glad to have you here. And Dax is going to offer a few comments after Dick's presentation, and then we can open it up to the room and Sherry will moderate the talk. So, bon chance. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, and thank you for this invitation. It's lovely to see some familiar faces. And yes, I am a graduate of this law school.
I
that should have been at the top of my resume, really, shouldn't it? And I'm delighted that one of my professors from many years ago is in the back there. My go-to reference for many years. I apologize for that, you know. In any event, I'm delighted to be here. And Dax, thanks for your willingness to do this. I guess I should begin with a bit of a confession. This book began as a second edition of the book I wrote on freedom of expression a long time ago. And the press, U of T Press, was very keen to not use the original name, the Constitutional Protection of Freedom of Expression, which just, you know, didn't exactly jump out at you as something you wanted to grab and read. And of course, the reality is that 24 years ago, social media was not a thing. I mean, the internet was barely a thing, but social media was not a thing. And that's changed everything in so many ways. So I was sort of willing to agree that, okay, I can see this is a different book, but much of the theory remains the same, even though how it applies, how it operates is different in this new landscape. So that's my sort of, you know, confession to begin with. I'm a little less prolific than it makes it sound. Okay, so let me say a few things. And if I don't think I'm going to go too long, but if I seem to be going too long, do signal to me that I am. So what's that? Awesome. Yeah, okay, that's fine. I can take a hint. Anyway, let me begin by saying that my thinking about freedom of expression begins with a very, very simple observation. And that is that the freedom doesn't just protect the individual liberty from state interference, that it protects the individual's freedom to communicate with others, to speak to others, and to hear what others have to say. In other words, the right of the individual is to participate in an activity that is deeply social in character and that relies on collective or social resources like the internet or public spaces of different kinds. And so my key argument, put in very, very basic terms, is that freedom is valuable because human agency and identity emerge in discourse, in the joint activity of creating meaning. That in expressing ourselves and giving, you know, linguistic form, I guess, to our ideas and feelings, we give them shape. We come to understand them ourselves more clearly, or in the words of Charles Taylor, we bring them to fuller and clearer consciousness. We understand our ideas, our feelings, when we put them before ourselves in linguistic form, and also when we experience the reactions of others to these ideas and so forth. And of course, at the same time, the listener, the audience, their views are reshaped in the process of trying to understand, to comprehend what's being said, and to place them within whatever is their frame of understanding. Now, the social character of human agency and identity is seldom mentioned in the traditional accounts of the value of free speech, but I think it lies at the foundation of each. So I don't understand myself as offering an alternative account. I understand myself as offering an elaboration of some kind. Each of the traditional accounts of the value of freedom of expression that talk about democracy or self-realization or truth, knowledge, each one of them represents a particular perspective on or dimension of the formation, the constitution of human agency in shared life, in community life. Now, the established accounts of the value of freedom of expression are often described as either instrumental or intrinsic in character, where it's concerned with the realization of a social goal of some kind or the protection of an individual right. Some accounts see freedom of expression as valuable in itself, intrinsically valuable. And it's intrinsically valuable because, on this account, it enables free and rational individuals to express their ideas or feelings, or it's important to protect the freedom out of respect for the autonomy or rationality of the individual. Other accounts, of course, see the freedom is important because it contributes to a valued state of affairs. Freedom of expression is said to be instrumental to the realization of social goods, such as public knowledge or the operation of a democratic form of government. However, I think that once we recognize that individual agency and identity emerge in the social relationship of communication, this traditional split between intrinsic and instrumental accounts, or social and individual accounts, of the value of expression dissolves. The arguments that are described as instrumental focus on the contribution of speech to truth, knowledge, and democracy, but we value truth, to begin with, not as an abstract social achievement, but rather as something that is consciously realized by members of the community, individually and collectively, in the process of public discussion. Similarly, freedom of expression is not just a tool or instrument that contributes to democratic governance. We value freedom of expression, not just because it provides individuals with useful political information, but more fundamentally because it is the way in which citizens participate in collective self-governance. There's no way to separate the goal from the process, or the individual good from the public good. And attaching the label intrinsic to autonomy or self-realization-based accounts of the freedom, I think also misdescribes the value that's at stake. Communication is a joint or public process in which individuals, as I've argued, realize their human capacities. When an individual communicates with others, they don't simply express their pre-existing views on things. Again, the individual's views, and more broadly, their judgment, their identity, take shape in the communicative process. All right. Recognition that individual agency and identity emerge in communicative interaction is crucial to understanding not only the value of expression, but also its potential to do harm. Our dependence on expression means that words can sometimes be harmful in different ways. Words can threaten, they can harass, they can undermine self-esteem. Expression can also be deceptive or manipulative in character. And I won't explore this here, but in many of the debates about freedom of expression and its limits and when it should be limited or not, the question is whether or not the issue is often whether or not the expression engages the audience or encourages independent judgment, or whether instead it intimidates, harasses, or manipulates the audience. All right. A commitment to freedom of expression means that an individual must be free to speak to others, to hear what others want to say without interference from the state. And it said that the answer to bad or erroneous speech is more speech, the kind of standard answer, not censorship, but more speech. And importantly, in this idea, the listener and not the speaker is responsible as an independent agent for the actions they may take in response to the speech, whether or not they agree with the speech and take some action that might be regarded as harmful, or they disagree with the speech and respond in some way like that. In other words, to respect the individual and his or her autonomy as either speaker or listener means that speech is not ordinarily regarded as a cause of harm. The speaker does not cause harm simply because they persuade. This is the starting assumption when we're thinking about what free speech protects and doesn't protect. Underlying the commitment to freedom of expression and the refusal to treat speech as a cause is a belief that humans are substantially rational beings, capable of evaluating factual and other forms of information they may receive, and also that public discourse, an assumption at least, that public discourse is open to a wide range of competing views that can be assessed by the audience. The claim that bad speech should not be censored, but instead answered by better speech, depends on both of these assumptions, the reasonableness of human judgment and the availability of competing perspectives. And there may be a third, although less obvious, assumption that underpins the protection of a freedom of expression, and that's that the state has the effective power to either prevent or punish harmful action by the audience. Individuals may sometimes make poor judgments, and the community's willingness to bear the risk of such errors in judgment may depend on the state's ability to prevent harmful actions, or at least to hold those who engage in them, audience members who may engage in harmful actions, to hold them to account for their actions. All right, freedom of expression doctrine has always recognizes, always permitted, the restriction of expression that occurs in a context or in a form that discourages independent judgment by the audience, or at least impedes the audience's ability to assess the claims made and the implications of acting on those claims. The courts recognize, in other words, that the assumptions about the audience's agency and judgment, which underlie the protection of speech, may not always hold, and certainly never hold perfectly. So you're all familiar with Holmes, you know, famous example of the false yell of fire in the crowded theater. And that's seen as, of course, an exception to free speech protection, because in such a case, the theater audience is not in a position to stop and reflect upon the merits of the claim and try to verify whether it's true or not, and is likely to act in an impulsive way that may cause injury to others. I gather Holmes actually drew on real life examples where that had occurred in different theaters in the United States, where fires in theaters was not an uncommon thing. So in other words, there are situations where it's always been accepted that speech can be treated as a cause of audience action when the time and space for independent judgment are compressed, or when emotions are running so high that audience members are unable or unlikely to stop and reflect upon the claims that are being made. When speech incites or manipulates the audience to take harmful action, the speaker then may be seen as responsible for, and perhaps even as a participant in, the harm that may follow. Now, the line, of course, between what we might call a conscious appeal, rational argument on the one hand, and on the other hand, manipulation and incitement, is not easy to draw, and indeed, it's almost certainly a very relative matter. But it's at least possible to identify some of the circumstances or conditions in which independent judgment is significantly constrained. What happens, though, when the assumptions underlying our commitment to freedom of expression, about the reasonableness of discourse or the availability of competing perspectives and so forth, what happens when these are eroded or undermined by more systemic changes in public discourse and not just in isolated situations? Before the rise of the internet, there were two significant factors that that free speech doctrine had to contend with, even though it probably didn't contend with them very well. And one was the rise of, say, lifestyle advertising or image-based, you know, messaging as the kind of dominant form of communication, initially in the commercial context, but it came to also very much shape political speech, very much a matter of image-based. And certainly the courts struggled with how to fit that in. One of my concerns was, and this is something explored in the book, I won't say much here, is instead of trying to look carefully at what might count as the constraints on independent judgment, the courts often just shifted to a kind of behavioral discourse in which they just said, oh, the speech causes harm here. And that really raised real challenges, I think, to how we thought about free speech. The other problem, of course, was the private ownership of the principal means of communication, the principal platforms of public conversation, newspapers, broadcasters, and so forth. And of course, adding to that, the concentration of ownership of these different platforms. And of course, the reality was that these corporate-owned enterprises would put forward a range of views, but those views were often constrained and didn't necessarily offer a full range of perspectives that might be useful and important and in fact held by a number of individuals in the community. Now, the emergence of the internet, social media in particular, as an important conduit for personal conversation and public discussion, seemed at least initially to lessen concerns about media filtering and unequal access to communicative resources and so forth. The internet certainly did open the conversation to more voices. It became possible for individuals to bypass existing media structures and to communicate with others without being those communication being filtered out by those who controlled the principal platforms. Now, The internet, of course, while providing access to a wide range of speakers and viewers, the reality is that the sheer volume of material that is posted online without internet users as a practical matter have available to them or are only able to view a tiny portion of what is out there. As a consequence, users tend to expose themselves to a relatively narrow range of opinions, generally those that reinforce their existing views. This kind of selective action, of course, selective access, excuse me, occurs by choice, but it also occurs by design. I'm sure I'm just saying things that you're all familiar with at this point, so forgive me for that. But I mean, the habit of going to sources that confirm one's existing views, what's described as confirmation bias, is reinforced by the algorithms used by search engines such as Google or platforms like YouTube and so forth, that direct individuals to sites and posts that are similar to those that they have visited in the past. Search engines, platforms, of course, are designed to maintain attention. And it turns out that attention is maintained most often by taking people to places, to sites that reinforce their existing views and even those that are highly sensational in character. So that's sort of one important problem or issue. On platforms such as Facebook, individuals share stories with close friends, social acquaintances, political allies, what we call euphemistically a broad group of friends in some way. Generally, people who are like-minded in character. When competing positions, at least, are formed around particular social groups that may be linked by religion or ethnicity, class, location, and so forth, debate between groups ceases to be about persuading others or understanding their views, but instead becomes a declaration of group identity or allegiance. An individual's beliefs, even beliefs about factual matters, then are often not based on judgment or reason, but instead on group membership. This means that even if social media users are not entirely insulated from opposing views, they are often unwilling or unable to engage with those views in a serious way. This divide, as we discover, is often reinforced by interested corporate and political actors. The online news sites that many rely on often provide users with what's described as partisan confirming disinformation, even an opinion, and at the same time discourage others to encourage others to distrust other sources as generating false news. And so even when partisans are exposed to the positions or claims of the other side, they often just discount those views right off the bat. The shift to social media as the principal platform for public engagement, I accept that. The shift to social media as the principal platform for public engagement has added to the ways in which speech can be harmful, while at the same time undermining the effectiveness of traditional legal responses to harmful speech. Forms of speech in the past may not have been regarded as sufficiently harmful to justify legal restriction have become more harmful or more dangerous in the online world. So disinformation, for example, may not have been a significant problem in a world where the media, for all its faults, sought to filter out false claims. Until recently, the legal prohibition of disinformation was generally limited to particular types of deceit or falsehood, false advertising, defamation, forms of speech like that. In the online world, however, false or misleading claims, again, unimpeded by media filters, spread quickly and widely to individuals who are often not in a position to assess the reliability or trustworthiness of the source of these claims. As a consequence, disinformation has become a much larger and much more serious problem for public discourse. And in fact, I will suggest in a minute, it may be a far greater problem than censorship when we're talking about the state of public discourse now. if manipulation in advertising was a concern before the arrival of social media, it's a much greater problem now. The use of data collected by internet platforms has enabled, has made possible micro-targeted advertising, ads that are directed to particular individuals or small groups of individuals based on a reading of their concerns, their biases, their fears, their priorities, whatever it might be. And these ads often take place outside of any public scrutiny. The individual receives them may imagine that these ads are being delivered to a wide range of, you know, other individuals, but in fact, they're not. And so it makes certainly addressing or contradicting what might be false in these particular ads far more difficult. Certainly, micro-targeted advertising during election campaigns has raised concerns about the integrity of the electoral process. And there are some proposals, and maybe we can talk about them recently. There's some new legal measures, in fact, have been introduced about ads being placed in a public repository of some kind and addressing some false claims that may be made in ads during election campaigns about the qualifications of a candidate or locations of voting booths and so forth, polls. Legal prohibitions on insult and harassment have generally been confined to particular contexts like the workplace, in which targeted individuals can't easily avoid direct personal exposure to denigrating comments. However, in the online world, speech that is insulting or denigrating, although not occurring face-to-face or in a closed environment, can be repetitive, difficult to avoid, widespread, enduring in character. Harassment has also taken new forms online, such as the sharing and public posting of intimate images of a person without their consent, or doxing, or coordinated mobbing, coordinated attacks on somebody. So uncivil communication in the past has been tolerated as a necessary cost to protection of free speech, enabling individuals to express strong emotions, to challenge conventions of public discussion. However, harassing speech has now become so commonplace, so nasty in character, and so difficult to avoid that it threatens to undermine public discourse by intimidating users into silence or driving them from social media platforms. Hate speech, I'll say not much about it, but it now spreads very rapidly and very widely through increasingly large fragments of or networks of friends and allies out there. Even if we think that a particular form of speech is harmful and perhaps should be regulated, the traditional legal responses seem to be inadequate to the task. Criminal prosecution for hate speech, for example, it's just too slow, too cumbersome to address harmful speech online, hate speech online, that can be posted anonymously, again, that circulates quickly and widely. Any legal response to unlawful or harmful speech must involve social media platforms, requiring them to take some initiative to filter out or take down material. And of course, they, given the sheer volume of material online, they rely on automated means to try to identify what might be unlawful material that's being posted. Again, this book predates the introduction of the Online Harms Bill, but it anticipated the introduction of something like it, because that was what was occurring in various jurisdictions. And it seems like, for all its faults, something like putting in place a duty to act responsibly, to design algorithms and ways to attempt to identify unlawful material, to remove it or prevent its posting, with some oversight and consultation with a government agency, presumably to also ensure that free speech interests are protected at the same time, seems like the only way to go. This kind of co-regulation model has its faults. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to catch stuff sometimes it shouldn't. It's going to miss stuff that it should catch, ideally, but it may be the only practical response at this point, and we'll see. It may be that this bill dies before it's enacted if we suddenly find ourselves with a new government led by somebody who as I recall, when before the bill was even introduced, said he was against it without actually reading it, and then said, oh, hate speech, that's just going to be whatever Justin Trudeau hates. And I thought, boy, we're in real trouble. You know, I mean, that's only one small way in which we're in real trouble. But I think it's hardly controversial to express grave concerns about the government that's coming. But